Amazon 5-star Theater presents Real Customer Reviews, performed by a real serious improv podcaster. Tonight's review, Spatula for the Stars. When I'm dead and civilization eventually collapses, this spatula will remain. It will be the only rune uncovered by some unknown species of the future upon which they base their assumptions of our existence.
Eggs!
They will posit.
These extinct people like to eat their eggs! And this was their primary tool for cooking them. Let us teleport and put this device in the Milky Way exhibit.
5 stars, Zachary. Find your perfect gift this holiday on Amazon.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Anything to lose. I have no secrets to hide. I could just be blunt and people could judge it however they judge it.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning into Truth and Justice. You are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 17, Episode 20, If Something Should Happen to Me. This week we heard a confession from Gerald Matthews about the quintuple homicide. We also heard Bob break down the contents of the confession, and we have a lot of questions about it. And Bob, Janet, and I are here to get into all of them. But before we do that, do we have any housekeeping?
I don't think so. Just like with Thanksgiving, just giving you guys a heads up that we will have a week off around Christmas time.
Sorry,
don't know when.
You didn't have to hear that.
Somewhere in there. We'll be off. Janet, I think you're muted. Other than that, no, I don't think we have any. We're still, you know, waiting on DNA results for the West Memphis 3, which should be due in any time. Yeah, nothing else really going on right now. Other than that, we got a ton of questions on this. We're recording this on Monday for this, in case for those of you that do like to be in the live streams that haven't caught on, that we're trying to do the follow-ups on Mondays now. So it's like a day after the main episode airs, and it's been working out good. We got a ton of questions come in. And some really good listener insights that I'm excited to dig into. One listener in particular had a kind of a different theory than mine that I like much better than my theory. I don't know if it made the cut, but if not, I'm going to bring it up anyway.
Everything. I think pretty much everything did, unless it was like a carbon copy repeat sort of someone else's comment. But
good. Yeah. Good. So you guys kind of knew a little bit about this before it came in. But I'll touch briefly with you guys on what you guys thought about it, your thoughts, and then we'll move into all these listener questions.
JV, if you want to go first.
Well, this is definitely one where I feel like all of our wonderful listeners who weighed in pretty much captured how I felt about all of it. You know, it's definitely one of those when you pull back and look at the possibility of the potential story here as involves Shaky in some way or another, it's very cinematic, which isn't to say that's not how real life works, but it is a hell of a story. You know what I'm saying? And so I think, and I'll be interested to, I kind of saved, I don't want to say it's a downer, but I saved a very pragmatic comment for towards the end, because I wanted to kind of save it and maybe talk about it before, not talk about it while we still have all these other things to talk about, because you'll kind of see why, but that it is concerning how much of a story it is, because I just worry that it will get written off if it is indeed the truth. I'm being a little vague because we have all these listener comments,
yeah. But
you know, it's kind of diabolical if some version of the theory that you posit on the episode is true. And I'm sure it's provided a lot of conversation and a lot of questions and thoughts.
Yeah. I'll put it out there now. It's kind of a housekeeping thing. It's kind of a correction that is one of the reasons why I like the listener theory that came out better than my own. So I had mentioned in the episode that, you know, this investigation was going on and they were working towards an appeal. And maybe that's why the heat was on when all this happened. What I learned today was that was not the case. So the series of affidavits in 2010, all those got, you know, there was investigators that talked to all those people. They got those affidavits. They filed an appeal with that. And then the court, and there's obviously very technical terms about exactly what happened here that I'm sure I'm not getting right. This information came to me right before we came on the air. But essentially back in like 2010 or 2011, the court refused to hear the appeal based on those affidavits. So they said there wasn't enough there to reopen another kind of second bite at the apple type of thing. So that ended in 2010 or 2011. And then the Gerald Matthews confession came about in 2014. And the only reason that distinction matters is because I kind of based the theory on there was all this heat going on, and it does not appear that was the case. It appears that, you know, they did all that investigation, they tried it, it didn't work. And then there was, you know, Fran Watson and her team were working on the case, but they weren't out beating the streets as they had already done. The previous legal team had already done 4 years prior. So I just want to give that context before we move any further.
So in other words, what you're saying is, as it would have potentially been perceived by word on the street or perceived by people who might have been involved in the case, it would have been happening kind of in a lull period, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It would have seemed to anybody on the street, like if this had come up in 2010, there was definitely investigators out there knocking on doors, tracking people down. In 2014, that not only wasn't the case, but it hadn't been the case for a few years.
Zach, what did you think?
It was extremely interesting and compelling because there's a ton of guilty knowledge in there.
Yes.
More mm-hmm. so, I want to say more so, obviously more so than Chris Bynum's confession, so-called. But like it, there's so much guilty knowledge and it kind of closes all the holes. Like why Liz and Sheila are where they are. You know, the idea of that they were out there to have intercourse, which can state why one of them is partial undressed. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? There's these little things that there's so much guilty knowledge, and yet there's these little things. And one of the things that I caught that I'm not sure about, I don't even know why it stuck out to me, but the idea that he talks about kicking the lamp.
Yeah, that I was just going to bring that up. That was one of the things when I first heard it that felt like, oh, that's somebody just throwing a detail in.
Right. They know, I mean, I don't want to say they know, but in the crime scene photos, we know the lamp is tipped over.
Right.
We can see it. So they have to make up something that happened with this lamp. But I feel like if you were really there and you're going through this traumatic experience of shooting, you know, you just shot two people, then you go to the house and shoot three more, maybe you did kick the lamp. But is that a detail that you remember?
So here's my thing with that. I had my initial reaction, like I said, was the same as yours. I'm like, but then I thought, like, that's not like a big public detail that was out there, that the lamp was tipped over behind. The crime scene photos certainly weren't available to anyone. Like, Indiana, right. I've mentioned this before, is so difficult to get FOIA requests or get any information. No one had seen these photos before. I don't think anybody's really seen them in publicly until I put them on our website. I think that's the first time they've ever been shared publicly. So it's like, well, where would they get that information? And then I thought back to, because we know what we know, it feels like, oh, the lamp's kicked over, or the lamp's knocked over, so he just said, I kicked the lamp over to try to make it fit with the crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
But then I took a step back and I'm like, well, but nope, but how many people knew that? How many people knew about that lamp? And then I thought back to what he didn't say was, I turned the lights out and I left. So now if we go back to, does it just fill in a gap in a way that we didn't think of before? Because remember, Larry's story was he heard them say, turn the lights off, and they or cut the lights, whatever, and they took off. What if, you know, the only light they had on at 1 o'clock in the morning in the living room was the lamp? And when they said turn the lights off to cut the lights, He kicked the lamp over.
Interesting.
And got out of there. So then all of a sudden, so it's kind of where I landed on it is I went from thinking that was the first thing that I heard that I flagged as bullshit to coming back around to being like, actually, it's maybe more subtle than we think, because no one knew, as far as I know, no one, it wasn't discussed at trial. It wasn't a big deal. It wasn't in the newspapers. Those photos aren't anywhere. How would somebody know the lamp was kicked over? Or the lamp was knocked over. We don't know if it was kicked over, but the lamp was knocked over unless they were there. And they didn't add the detail where you would expect, like what we see, if when, and like, especially in like a coerced confession, like think Jesse, Miss Kelly, where they start like throwing details in, they know to get them to say, you know, that's where you expect to hear that kind of thing. Like, well, Larry said the lights were turned off. So say you turned the light, because that's what we see in Chris's confession, right?
Right.
Like, yeah. So, you know, I turned the lights off and I left because that fits with what Larry said. This doesn't fit what Larry said in a very simplistic standpoint of turned the lights off, but it very much fits with what Larry said if that's how they killed the lights, was kicking the lamp over. So yeah, I kind of came full circle on the lamp thing.
That's really interesting.
I feel like it could go either, and there aren't any lamp specific comments in here, so we're definitely not spoiling anything from listeners, but I feel like it could go either way, and I feel like there's a middle version where it feels like it's inserted to prove guilty knowledge. Like it feels like it's like, like, you know, everyone always hears like, what's something only the killer would know?
Right.
Like you have to, you know, the police always hold something back. And that feels, it's said in such a matter of fact, like step one, step two, step three, I kick the lamp, blah, blah, blah. Like without it being really attached to anything, attached to this, the anxiety and attached to worrying about the lights, to your point, that it just feels very clinical. And I think the clinical aspect of it is what jumps out at first as being like, that's feels right. like bullshit. Could the middle version be, it feels clinical because the person telling the story doesn't know why that's important, but it is a bullet point, not unlike Jay Wilds, a bullet point that needs to be hit for a certain reason. That doesn't mean that it's not true. And it doesn't mean that it's bullshit. Like, it doesn't mean it's bullshit. And it also doesn't mean he was the one there. It's very mysterious to me.
So I look at it as, and I think I said this in the episode, that like, it's guilty knowledge, but is it guilty knowledge because he experienced it? Or is it guilty knowledge because someone who had guilty knowledge told him? But I will posit, I think that's a solid theory. I also will posit another theory in the fact that what I had in multiple listens through this and then reading it, I realize part of what is jumping out at me as red flags is the fact that he's reading off a script. And I think the fact that so like, and you can tell by the vernacular in the handwritten document, which I apologize. I'm behind on getting case documents up. I've just been swamped with a bunch of other things. So I'm going to try this week to get all this up so you guys can see it. Somebody also asked if I can put up the picture of Gerald Matthews. I'll do that too. But when you read it, if you're reading it as opposed to listening to him, you can see like, oh, he's like, someone was dictating this. Like he was just talking, telling the story. But then when he does the video, now he's reading off a script and the whole thing sounds very mechanical. It sounds, there all the emotions taken out of it. And it's almost like to me that it tricked me, right? When I'm hearing it, it's like, oh, this is bullshit. He's just saying what somebody's telling him to say. But like, if the process was, which I suspect it was, that I really think that what happened was he dictated it to the notary. The notary wrote it down for him, and then he read off of it. I don't think he's that great of a reader, maybe, or at least not a reader out loud. I'm not either, by the way. But I think the process of him reading off of that paper, because you notice there's a very distinct tone change in that one spot I shared where he like went off script, where he sounds like a normal human for that 15 seconds,
right?
You know, where he's like very mechanical, and then it's like he realized, oh, there's something missing from here, and then he just kind of goes off script, and then he sounds normal, and then he kind of goes back on script again. So I think what you were saying is possible. And I think it's also possible that the whole thing sounded bullet pointed because he was reading it instead of just saying it. Like maybe if they had recorded him saying it the first time when he was just like just telling the story, dictating it, that I think it might have sounded more. I wish we had that, because that's something that, you know, a linguist or, you know, a behavioral analyst that really studies that kind of spoken word could have something to work with and pick up indicators of veracity within there.
Yeah. I think there's the part that stands out to me that is exactly what you're talking about is the part where he's talking about Robert Carr and then he says he died in a car accident and then it moves on. Mm-hmm. That seems like something that like you and I are talking. I said that to you, but you're taking notes and you wrote all of that down.
Yeah.
And now he's going back to read it, even though it's an insignificant thing.
Like it was an aside.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause he said, yeah, Robert G, he died in a car accident and then it didn't flow with the script.
Right.
As though it was like, he's, you know, then, you know, Robert Carr was only directly involved. Like, oh, he died in a car accident.
Correct.
And they wrote it down. Mm-hmm. And so he read it into the script.
Yeah.
So I do have one more question that is not, I read through the questions that is not covered. Could be absolutely nothing. I'm reading what I was thinking. And pardon me if I get the wrong person. It's between Liz and Sheila at the ball field. And he talks about hitting Liz with the club.
Yeah.
And then she ran and then he shot her twice.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it would be possible for her to run after that being hit with that club? Because it seems like that would incapacitate her. Now,
yeah.
I know that's, who knows what could happen, but just from seeing the damage that it caused,
yeah,
it seems unlikely to me that she would have been able to run.
That's a good point. I don't know, but there was definitely like severe brain trauma, but there, you know, there could be a delay for, you know, however long it takes for the brain to swell to where, you know, if we're talking about a couple of seconds, I really don't know, but that's a good point.
Yeah, I thought that too, but then I guess I did think about all the times I've been more seriously hurt than I realized, and the adrenaline was pumping so hard that all right. I could think about was getting up or getting away and then sort of succumbing to something, you know, deeper.
I feel that as well, but the fact that this is a very significant head injury that, yeah. I mean, the
like
skull
it could have maybe
crushed.
Rendered her unconscious.
Yeah, the skull is crushed in that portion that she is hit. So, I mean, it, I don't know. It just seemed like,
yeah, that's a good,
that's
it's
a really
point.
Good question. That's a really good question.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
By law, 21 plus, terms and conditions apply. At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Well, before we get deeper into kind of analyzing the theories and some of the things surrounding the story, I'm just going to start with a couple. I don't want to call them housekeeping about this episode. That's not really what it is, but just some interesting feedback on some more of the kind of notary side of things. Brooke contributed, not really a question, but I'm a notary in California and we are authorized to take legal depositions as part of our commission. Not sure how Indiana law works for notary commissions, but that might explain why the notary wrote everything on his behalf.
Yeah, I think that's a distinct possibility. And I don't know that there's, I mean, this is not a deposition, but at the same time, so for when I've taken statements that I've had notarized, I'm not a notary, but like, for example, Sonia Lucas, the affidavit that I was able to take from that case and from Jody's case in season 15, you know, that was, she dictated that to me. And you know, the way I handled it was, you know, I recorded everything from the minute I walked in and the minute I left to make sure that I could turn, when I turned it over to the attorney general's office, like, this is not me, this, that information came from her. But I typed it out when she told me the story and then I read it back to her. I'm like, so is this correct? And I typed it through and then I had a notary there with them. So I could imagine the same thing. So like saying that like the notary may have been the one to write everything down. Like I didn't mean that in a way that like to sound like it was like nefarious that she did. I'm really just trying to figure out what the hell happened here. And I'm going to talk about more on Sunday. I think I'm still wrestling with how, what I'm going to put together exactly for this week. The situation gets even more confusing.
Oh,
like
no.
We have, yeah. Well, I'll tell you this, because one of our listeners like pointed out, I had already found it out. Remember last week I said, like right before we record the follow-up, I'm like, I just found something out about the episode that I already recorded after I recorded it.
Yeah.
That was it. I found out the name of the person that delivered the Gerald Matthews package to the attorneys. Like it's in the PCR testimony. This person testified. I'm like, oh, cool. Now I can figure it out. And then I read it and I was like, nope, that didn't help at all. So it's confusing enough that I need to, I'm not going to talk about it here because it'll distract from everybody, but it's freaking weird.
Okay. Well, Olivia says, for what came to mind for her about the mystery mailer slash address was that maybe the return address is a house that the person could maybe nanny for, or maybe be a cleaner of. She says, I could see a world where someone is so afraid of what could happen to them as a middleman that they don't want to use their actual address, but use an address that quickly came to their mind.
Yeah, so I thought something similar. And what I found was, first of all, it was a man. The return address was Melissa Williams. It was a man. And that address, we get no indication that he has any connection to that house at all.
You're saying you now know for sure that a man was responsible for sending...
Yes. Yeah, and says that, similar to what's being said there, didn't want to get involved, so put somebody else's name and address on it. But then the attorneys are asked, well, why did you choose that address? And it was like, I just wanted to pick it. Like, it's way too complicated for me to get into the weeds in it right now, but it's not just like a complicated story. It's a story that just doesn't make sense to me. So, yeah, we'll get into it.
Okay. Heather says, in the follow-up, Shaky and Chris are referred to as having been at the VFW playing pool together. But that's not Chris's testimony from his PCR hearing. Chris testified that he went there by himself. He also stated that he went to the bathroom, and when he returned, Shaky was shooting his game. An argument ensues, and it seems that it may have even become physical. That certainly eliminates the idea that they were friends. Additionally, if it was a neighborhood hangout, that certainly doesn't suggest that they were there together. And then Hope added, What if this was the Chris that was with Shaky and our Chris also just happened to be there?
That was, thank you, Heather, for sharing. Heather had commented that or posted that earlier in the week, and I asked her to put it in the follow-up post because it's a really good distinction that I never caught until she did. Because, yeah, I've said that, oh, they were there, they were friends, they were there shooting pool together. But I went back and reread, and she's right, and it is an important distinction. He didn't say, you know, I took as, well, he was playing my game, that, you know, they were playing pool together and he picked up on it. But no, what he said is, I went to the bathroom and, you know, I what I'm picturing is, you know, if you've ever played pool in a bar, you put your quarters on the table and that's how you keep track of who gets to play next. That, you know, he had his marker up and he came back and it was his turn and Shaky took his turn and that's what led to this whole, yeah, so... He doesn't say at all that they were friends or hanging out or shooting pool together. They got an argument because Shaky tried to take his spot. As far as, you know, if there could, the other Chris could have been there, it's possible. But also when I've said, like, we know they were in the VFW together, it's from people that have like relayed that story that they were there getting into that argument together, which Chris acknowledges happened, that the argument did happen. So it doesn't mean there wasn't another Chris there, but that's what I meant by that they were there together. Not that they were hanging out, but people said they like, yeah, they were there shooting pool and they got in an argument.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the next handful, there's some overlap, and I was trying to figure out a way to kind of consolidate or maybe just pick one, but I feel like everyone has little nuggets that we might want to address. So bear with me if there's a little bit of overlap in some of these, but I want to start. So this is getting into kind of the theory or the speculation about how what this all could mean. Faith says, Bob stated that Matthews doesn't, this is Gerald, that Matthews doesn't appear to be under duress in the video, but the theory is he is being coerced to make the confession. He makes the statement because he's in a situation that might result in his death, but the theory is the situation that results in his death is someone wanting that statement released. Are we even 100% sure it is Matthews in the video or that it was recorded when we're told it was?
Yes to both of those questions, but no, so first of all, when I said he doesn't appear to be under duress, I meant, you know, there's not somebody like in the room with him holding a gun to his head making him do this. That does not appear to be the case. But also, as I mentioned earlier, with new information and with this other theory that's come out, I agree that I'm trying to piece together what could make sense here. And the more I think about it, I agree with you, actually, that it doesn't make a lot of sense that Shakey's like, you need to do this, especially then knowing now that there wasn't any heat on him at that moment. I keep dancing around it, but do you have in the outline the person who had put kind of a theory about an alternate theory about what they think happened?
Was it Murray? Because we have a couple of things in there. What do you think of this as a variation of the theory?
Didn't we just do that one right now? I don't want to screw you up, but
there's only one before that. So that's totally fine. Okay. Yeah. So Murray says, what do you think of this as a variation of the theory? Word on the street has Shakey and Gerald shook. Gerald wants to confess and Shakey says, keep me out of it. So Gerald does. But Gerald knows that might not be good enough, and Shakey may kill or have someone else kill him anyway. Another option is that Gerald decided to keep Shakey out of it to protect the person who helped him and anyone else he cares about.
Yeah, so I think that's a version of that, I think, is a much more plausible theory in that you know, whether it's because of there's heat on him or there's not, but for whatever reason, if Gerald, who was Chris Stokes, known by everybody as Chris at that time, did have some sort of guilty conscience, and he's like, I need to come clean. I think some version of a scenario where, you know, he tells Shakey, like, dude, I can't live with this anymore. I gotta come clean. I'm gonna confess. And Shakey's like, dude, you better, you know, whatever Shakey says, essentially telling him, I'm not going down with you. You better not do that. And, you know, he says, well, I'll keep you out of it or whatever. So either he tells him to keep him out of it, or he decides to keep him out of it because he doesn't want to take anybody else down with him. You know, that if Gerald genuinely made the confession, but also, yeah, like maybe the part he's afraid of is the fact that now he's told Shakey that he's going to confess and maybe he's getting threatened by Shakey. It's possible. I mean, there's a million, all of this is what's maybe possible, but I was thinking about it today, like after reading that, I'm like, well, it could even been, you know, Shakey could have not even known he made the, you know, because I doubt he told him, you know, I made a confession and if I die, then it's going to go. And it doesn't, I don't think that would have happened. He could have just been, you know, on Shakey's radar because he told him he was going to confess. He did this kind of in secret just in case. And then he ends up getting killed. It also could be him getting murdered had nothing to do with Shakey. There could have been a coincidence. There could have been another situation. But I think the idea of him deciding he was going to come clean and then leaving Shakey out of it, either because he's afraid of Shakey or because, honestly, I don't think that as much, because the whole concept was no one would know he did this until after he was dead. So him like putting Shakey into it doesn't really play into that. I think that he maybe just decided, or maybe told him, if I confess, I won't mention you. And he's trying to protect other people. I don't know. I know that's a lot of rambling thing, but I think there's something there to that theory more so than the theory that I came up with.
Well, and definitely, I mean, there is the slip where he says Robert Carr and other guys
were there. Yeah. And again, but he says the only one directly involved mm-hmm. was Robert Carr. And then he's directly involved just by saying shoot them.
Right.
Yeah. That was, he's definitely leaving out other people from that confession.
Yeah. Well, Faith says, and Garrett, I see you in the chat. Don't worry. You said you couldn't get in quick enough for the Facebook post, but Faith was there for you. and asked the question, has anyone been convicted of the murder of Gerald Matthews?
No. As far as I know, I did a little bit of checking on that today. And as far as we know, it was never really, you know, investigated. I'm sure it was like air quotes investigated, but it seemed like nobody ever really gave a shit about it. And there was the case was never solved.
Okay. So let's go to Sarah. Sarah says, Sheila is the fly in the ointment. Gerald's confession treats her like he knows her, but he calls her Sheila instead of Renee. He puts her in Amp's house doing drugs when she most likely went from the liquor store to the ball field. His story completely left out the state of undress of Sheila and Liz. Gerald's story doesn't sound like firsthand knowledge or even secondhand knowledge. It sounds like someone's theory of the case who didn't realize that Sheila shouldn't have been there. She was a complete stranger to the other victims.
That's a really good point. The part that sticks out to me the most that I hadn't thought of until you just said that is that she went by Renee. So that's an interesting. I didn't even think about that until they just said it. But that's a problem.
Yeah, as really, far as her really being, good post.
Yeah, as far as her being there, I mean, she's with Liz. So if you know, there certainly could be a world where Liz and Sheila go to the liquor store and then go to Amp's house. And then they're both already there when Gerald Matthews gets there. Like, I don't have a problem with that. I have a problem with them saying that they were getting high when they were there because we know they weren't. But yeah, that's interesting. He called her Sheila because he doesn't give a name to Angela or Suzanne. It's just Amp's girl and another white woman. But he knows that one as, you know, he knows Renee, who, you know, that's, you know, we just did that for us to keep everything straight because there was two people that go by Renee. That's a really good point.
Yeah, it's a really good point. And just to circle back, I know that we talked about this. You talked about it in your episode and we just mentioned it. But just to circle back to it for a second, he's in this confession. He says, by the time we got back to Amp's house, some other guys were there. Right. I mean, he doesn't even just say one other person. He's like some other. It's like, how many people were there? Like, how many people were there? And were are you saying those people were all there when Rob said kill him and then Gerald killed them?
Yeah. And it's another good distinction. You just pointed out that he said we got back. So and we does not include Rob Carr.
I might be misspeaking about that. I just said that, so I don't know. I could be wrong. Maybe he didn't say when. Maybe he said when I got back. I thought he said we though.
Yeah, I'll have to look at that because if he said we, then that's an important distinction. I'm actually going to look at that real quick.
Yeah, take a look because I may have just summed that up wrong.
Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad. And take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work. And I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, I just looked it up, and he does, in fact, say I. What he says is, I went to Amsky's house just to tell him to keep quiet about it. So he does not say we. Okay. He says I. So
and what does he say after that? I was like, holy crap.
Yeah, so right there is where... So yeah, we'll just read what he said. I went to Amsky's house just to tell him to keep quiet about me being with them. But his lady said she would tell. Rob G and some other guys was there by this time.
I mean, that's a big deal.
Yeah. So he says when he gets back, Rob and some other guys were already there at the house. So it's a weird thing because, like, I get the point that I don't remember which listener wrote this, but that it doesn't sound, you know, it's firsthand knowledge. Maybe it's other, because it is odd, because like we have no indication that there were other people there. But also, if you read Larry's first statement, he was at trial. They twisted it to where he heard all this arguing and stuff, right? And then the gunshots the second time. You know, in that second visit, he was hearing all the arguing. But what he originally said was, he was sound asleep and the gunshots woke him up. So if that's the case, like there could have been three other guys in there all hanging out, talking in the living room, whatever, when he got there. Because, you know, everything gets warped because the story got warped along the way. So I don't think that's a deal breaker. I'm still hung up. I'm still kind of reeling about the fact that he called her Sheila. Like, where does that make sense?
I think that's huge. But to me, it is also huge that we are now adding more human beings to this scene who neither shot anyone nor were shot themselves. They were just there. But every affidavit that we see, everything that happens, there's not like a bunch of people that are being named or a bunch of people that are being identified, right, going into houses and coming out or walking down the street or getting out of cars. It just seems like a bigger deal to be like, hey, I'm coming back to a scene. I just did something crazy. The people, right, who are there at this place have nothing to do, as far as we're understanding from this confession, mm-hmm, have no bearing on what happened with Liz and Sheila. And he comes back and says, don't tell anyone that I was with those women. Hey, guys, other guys who are already here, like that he's sort of separated himself from, until Rob is like, well, then you should just kill them. And then he kills only those three people, but now also the people who were also there know he was with those two women that he killed.
Yeah, it's the whole thing is, and it's hard to square with, like I said, they, you know, the witness that saw Shaky and Rob leaving, the witness that saw just Shaky leaving the ballpark. Like it's hard to square all that up. Like if there's like how many are some other guys? Say there's two, so there's what, three? So that means there's five people leaving, and then. Now, I can see what if it's like these are just, you know, their buddy Amp and his girlfriend and this other lady who are saying they're gonna snitch, they kill them. And if the other, because it sounds like Rob was a drug dealer. When the one witness, one of the affiants from a couple weeks ago, said that, you know, he was going to make some runs with him, I took that to mean he was going to deliver, you know, going to sell drugs. So if this is like a group of drug dealers that all hang out with it, you know, that they're just like, you know, that he trusts not to snitch on him, I could see. But it's still weird. Like you still left these other witnesses.
Exactly.
But it, to me is, you know, I just look at it, he's obviously, if this is a genuine confession, but he's, I, the whole thing when I'm leaning in, like, what is he not telling us in Shaky's name is not Nate. He's not telling us who the other people are. I think if that's what's happening, if what he's trying to do is sanitize Shaky out of it, then, you know, he could be just replacing Shaky with some other guys, you know, just, you know what I mean? Like, he's just, because there weren't other guys there. That's why it's nonspecific. He doesn't name anybody. It doesn't make sense. None of it adds up because there weren't other guys there. There was another guy there that was part of it. So, you know what I mean? I'm just spitballing.
Right. But the witness that was in the car says that Shaky walked in, like some other person walked into the house first and then Rob
behind
and they never
him.
Say like, so, and then someone else walked in behind Rob and that person was just sitting in the car the whole time.
Right.
So yeah, like so that it, like doesn't said, square.
It's really hard to square it with any of these specifically. And the trick is that, so it's like, and I'm not saying to do one or the other, but like what I wrestle with in situations like this is, do you throw the baby out with the bathwater? Is the whole thing just a complete made up bullshit? I'd want to know why. That's why it sucks that nobody knew it even existed until he was dead.
And how is it made up if he knows that it's the club and he knows about the lamp? Like there are pieces of information in there that didn't come from nothing.
Right. Yeah, so there's all these elements that like seem very much like guilty knowledge. There's him calling Sheila when she went by Renee. That's odd. You know, that doesn't fit. It doesn't square with these other things. So it's like I hesitate to just be like, the whole thing is, you know, it's coerced, fake, lie, bullshit, throw it out. But there's enough there to make it compelling, but at the same time, I can't take, and that's why I spent the time in that, you know, starting to, and we're continuing to now kind of in real time, break it down is like, I also can't just say, well, this helps Chris, so let's just accept it.
Right.
I can't do that either because there's a lot of problems with it.
Right.
Sue in the chat says, could he be calling her Sheila because at the time he didn't know her name? And at the time of the confession, he only knew her name from the trial.
Well, I wonder, one thing I've been rolling around in my brain during this conversation is, what if he knew someone who knew her, right? You know, if somebody, so it's not like, you know, from a newspaper or whatever where he would have all the names, but like he knew somebody who knew her that was like, oh yeah, Sheila Barty, you know, something like that. I don't know. Yeah. Cause you know, maybe he heard that later, but again, if he like read it in a newspaper or read it in a case file, then why don't we hear Angela and Suzanne too?
Right. Well, Allison says, could you remind us how cold it was that night? I really can't imagine any woman wanting to take someone to a ball field in the freezing cold to have sex. Maybe in a car, but with at least three people in a smallish car, that seems unlikely too. I have a hard time believing that's the reason for going to the ball field and that the sex was consensual.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what the temperature is. I don't remember, but I mean, there was snow on the ground. It was cold for sure. February in northwest Indiana is cold.
But if you leave the car in the heat, if you have a heater and you leave the car running, I guess.
Yeah. And I always thought, and actually, if you're listening to this, Colin, one of our listeners, Colin, had really done a really good job of like analyzing that crime scene and breaking it down. And I had actually reached out to him. So, Colin, check your Facebook messages to see if we could have him come on and break it down. Because I've always assumed that if there was some kind of sex that was going to be happening based on where like the first blood stain is, that it was like they were gonna do it in the dugout, because you know, but I don't know,
which really that seems very bizarre to me in terms of how like being outside,
yeah,
opposed to staying in a car. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, it's all, and it could just be staying in the car too. It's a remote spot. Maybe they went there to stay in the car, but I know it's also a world I'm not familiar with too, right? They like I was thinking like where else were they gonna go.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't going to do it and if that's what they were going to go do, they weren't going to do it at Amp's house with, you know, a house full of people and kids. They're not going to, like, it seems like there would be somewhere else they could go. But I don't know.
Monica in the chat, looking for some clarification here. Monica says, didn't he say that he hit Liz at the ball field and then put the women in the car and drove them into the woods, but the crime scene showed the women looked like they were shot or hurt in the woods?
No, he said he put the women and the car in the bushes, which is, that part is accurate, because Liz was, Liz was clearly dragged to her final resting place back in the bushes. It looks to me, and that's one of the reasons I want to talk to Colin too, it looks to me like Sheila was shot right there and dropped right where she stood. But it also, they just did such a bad job of documenting with crime scene photos for you to, you know, I'm not able to, like, I'm looking for, Sheila shot in the head. Is there blood spatter showing that's where, there's not enough angles for you to really piece this thing together to see if she was shot there. It just looks to me like she, collapsed right there. And there's not two drag marks, but I guess they could have drug them both in the same spot. But no, he didn't say he put them in the car. He said he just said he put both of the girls, the women, and the car into the bushes.
And what is your thought on, I mean, maybe you said this in the episode, there's this very information dense and a lot of confusing stuff is happening in this case. What is your feeling about one person controlling those two women in this situation as he describes it?
I mean, it's easy. A gun is a pretty powerful thing. So I've definitely seen and studied many cases where one person has controlled multiple people by holding a gun. I mean, think about somebody, a single person goes in and robs a bank and gets everybody to lay on the floor with one gun, so it's possible to control them in that situation if they have no way to get out of there. I think it's possible. The house crime scene is what is the one that makes me think it's very improbable that there was only one person, responsible for the shooting.
Becky says, was Gerald's DNA ever compared to what was collected from Sheila's rape kit? Because his story about Liz's threat doesn't match up with the evidence unless she threatened to turn him in for raping Sheila.
Yeah, well, I mean, he says that she said she was going to say that he raped her. He doesn't necessarily say that they actually had sex. As far as the answer to the question, I don't think so. Again, it's hard to get access to a lot of this information, but I have not seen any indication that the DNA, the DNA was run through CODIS. I've not seen any indication that it was run specifically against Gerald Matthews. And I don't know if his DNA is in the system, because again, that was, he was dead by 2014. He did do some time before that. Whether he would have, his DNA would have been in the CODIS system is unclear.
Okay. Heather says, were Gerald's fingerprints taken as part of the investigation into his murder? Were there any suspects in his murder? We've talked about this. If it's unsolved, wouldn't the evidence from his murder still be around somewhere? I know it's a stretch petition to get a DNA sample from it, but if Chris's attorney could pull that off somehow, it might fill in some gaps.
Yeah, I mean, what I know, I don't know if they took, I assume they have his fingerprints on file. He has an arrest record on file, but what I do know is the fingerprints haven't been run through APHIS or any kind of database. They've only been compared to specific people. So the fingerprints, I know for sure, haven't been compared to Gerald Matthews.
Hope says, the affiant who saw Shaky leaving the ballpark, perhaps they saw Gerald? Do Shaky and Gerald have the same build? Perhaps in the dark, they could be easily confused? Another theory is that the aforementioned affiant inserted Shaky into the ballpark story 10 years later because he knew Shaky was involved in the murders at the house. This was the one affidavit that didn't really fit with the others. Did this affiant have any connection to Gerald?
Not that I know of. And there's a lot of possibilities. One thing that I'm curious about that I'm looking into is the race of that affiant. Now, they made it seem like they know Shaky, they know what he looks like, and they know it was him. But, it's dark out, the person's running, if the affidavit's true. If this is a white person, I think most people know this, but if you don't, like, cross-racial identification is, it's even more unreliable than other eyewitness identification. And what I mean by that is, like, as a general stereotype, white people tend to look at a person of color, two people of color, and they see similarities there, whereas a person of color might look at those same two people of color and see very distinct differences in them. There's just something that happens in the brain, I think, that causes that to be a difficult distinction.
Simone, I think we've sort of covered the different pieces of your post in different places. But Simone did ask, do we have a handwriting comparison for Shaky? And then
I do not.
Okay. And then when was the DNA discovered in comparison to the timeline of this confession and its delivery?
No, I know I said that when the DNA was tested. It was after this. It was after. I want to say the DNA testing, I better go back and look. I know I talked about it at the time, the exact dates, but I believe that was done by Fran Watson's group, which they took over the case in like 2014, somewhere around there. It wasn't part of the initial investigation that was done prior to when the affidavits came out.
Heather, just circling back to Tidwell for a moment, Heather says, is Tidwell still a person of interest? And if his dad retired detective was trying to keep him out of trouble, he would have had to know that his son was in on it before they went after Chris. They went after Chris right off the bat. So that means either the younger Tidwell called his dad and said, hey, I messed up. Can you keep me out of trouble? Or his dad was also in on it somehow. Dirty cops have done worse. So at this point, it just wouldn't surprise me.
He's a person of interest because we know he has connection to Liz. We know he has connection to Liz on that night. So that's what makes him a person of interest in my mind. Yeah, as far as, I mean, look, if your dad's a cop, I don't think that you are involved in a sexual assault and murder, and then you call your dad like, hey, I just did this, so find somebody else. I don't think that's what happened. I think it's interesting that his dad was a cop at the time. I think that I think how that may have played in would be more if there were other, you know, like leads that were coming out that we never heard about, you know, because there's a complete lack of investigation here, where if maybe somebody was like, hey, I know Joe Tidwell Jr. was with her. I saw them together that night. If that just, let's just leave that out because we've already got Chris. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it was like, and I don't know, but I don't think it would have been something like, oh, I know my son's involved in this, arrest somebody else for it. I don't think it's that. I think it could be a possibility of, If truthfully, with these guys, from what I've read about them and what we've seen in this case, Donald specifically, it could have not been a cop's kid. I think that once they had Chris and had that confession, I think any lead that came in, they would have brushed away because they're like, we already got our guy. This case is closed. I'm not causing any more work for myself.
Gotcha. Last, I have Keita. I don't know if I'm saying your name right, Keita. I'm so sorry. Keita says, oi. In my last comments, I did not mention that I'm an attorney. I am. And this episode made me very sad. The reason is that as exciting as this all is, the defense team now has two deeply conflicting stories of the crime, especially if Shaky is not definitively implicated in Gerald's death. Any petition or motion in front of the court will be met with, well, you have these affidavits and this story that contradicts them. Why should I, the judge, believe either one of them is reliable? And also, going back to Keita, says, and also, as preposterous as it may seem, an argument can be made that if Shaky could influence/threaten, etc., Gerald, then why couldn't our Chris do the exact same thing and threaten Gerald? I do not think that's the case, but it is a theory prosecutors could push in response to any motions on Chris's behalf.
Yeah, well, I mean, they could certainly make the argument, but the difference to that last question is nobody's afraid of our Chris. He has no violent history. He's got no violent past. As opposed to Shaky, who has an extremely violent history and past, and people like people believe that he will kill you and your family if you cross him. As far as the first comment, yeah, that's kind of what we talked about last week. And again, this is exciting, but this phase of what we're covering right now is all in hindsight. Like, this stuff already happened. This has already been in front of appeals courts. It's already been denied. And we talked a little bit about last week about how, you know, I think that that's probably part of the reason why it was denied. I think if you had just this confession come out, I think it would have been more compelling to an appellate judge or panel of judges if you hadn't 4 years earlier had these four affidavits come out, because I think that made it easy for the prosecutor. And it's not like anybody's fault. Like, they're out trying to investigate, find information, but then now they're left with this. Well, shit, we got these four affidavits that are really compelling that are all implicating this guy. And then you got a confession from a completely different guy that says that guy wasn't involved. And you, these things exist and they've all been put in front of the court. It's real easy for the court. And I don't say easy like they're looking for an excuse, but it becomes very easy for the court to be like, I can't, like, you can't tell me here with this motion, we have all this evidence that this guy did it, so we know it wasn't Chris. Oh, wait, but here we have a confession where this guy says he did it, but he says that this other guy didn't do it. And, you know, I mean, so it all gets thrown out, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, just to hit this home again, you know, these are the kinds of conversations where it's, you know, looking back at the episode that came out maybe two or three episodes ago when we first caught, when you first unveiled the some of the DNA evidence and Tidwell's name came into it. And, you know, these are all people that we don't know if they were had anything to do with the deaths. We don't know that Jakey had anything to do with the deaths. We're right. not saying, hey, let's go out and accuse this person of having killed these people. This is just information that has come through from the defense side that is very important to talk about, in part because, as you said, this is such a mystifying case that it starts to feel like you have to know what really happened definitively to get Chris out of prison. And we're talking about all of the things that have been floated and all of the information that's out there. We're not sitting here saying like, gosh, I hope everyone knows now that Shakey's responsible for this. We don't know that at all.
Right. Yeah, we don't know any of it. And that's why, you know, I keep saying this and to be honest, just to give you a heads up, I'm really considering after the Christmas break, pausing for a bit, and we'll still do episodes, but just kind of, you know, doing some kind of one-off like we've done in other, like between seasons. Because this, what this is, like I said, this has all been litigated. It didn't work, but it's there's like these massive starting points for me that need to be investigated. And it's not like, for example, like Telia Caldwell, the notary. Okay, she was there when this happened. I need to talk to her. Somebody needs to talk to her. But it doesn't look like is me being like, hey, you want to do an interview for my podcast? That's not what that looks like. That's like in order to actually help Chris, I need to just go investigate her. I need to try to talk to Joe Tidwell. I need to try to talk to this guy that delivered this confession. I need to, yeah, like there's all these things that I need to do. So I'm in this weird, I've been in similar situations before, but never quite like this, where there was, you know, an investigation that happened post-conviction that opened all these doors. They were already denied, and we need to continue on investigating them. And so it's a weird situation to be in. But yeah, I think Telia will be a huge help if I can get her to speak with me. As far as I know, no one's ever talked to her before. Like, what the hell was going on? Like, there had to be more conversation than just what's written on that affidavit.
So please, everyone, we love you. Please don't try to find her or talk to her.
Yeah, don't.
This is not the time.
If you know her, if you just happen to be listening, you're like, hey, I know her. Let me know. Don't anybody go talk. Because again, these are things that could be, you know, it could result in something that leads to litigation. And if it gets muddied up because as awesome as you guys all are, that, you know, a bunch of listeners for a podcast, I'll talk to this woman first and like gave her information that needs to be. There's a very careful and strategic way to have these conversations to where, you know, again, like in Jody's case, I talked about earlier, the Sonia Lucas affidavit, like that process for me with the attorney general was they're like, okay, well, I have this affidavit, but I don't know how you got it. Like, did you feel that's, you know, like I was extremely careful, recorded from beginning to end. They literally heard me walk in the door. They heard me introduce myself. They heard the greeting. I didn't touch the audio, so the metadata shows exactly when it happened, you know, so they can hear the whole process, because it's very easy for one little thing to get it thrown out.
Well, wherever we end up going in the slightly less near future, you have an episode for us next week, and it sounds like you're adding more ingredients to this cauldron of confusion. I don't know what to
Well, think. I'm hoping that this episode will help clarify some things, because I've learned a little bit more. You know, I wanted to get these three episodes out where we put all this information out, where I could really take a week and study and analyze this stuff and try to figure out what the hell is going on here. Now we got a big jumble of everything that's out there right now. So yeah, this week, as you say, I have an episode for you, but I'm still trying to piece it together exactly what that looks like. I think I'm going to be having Dr. Nikki Jackson on again this week, and she's going to kind of help us unpack. She's got some other news to share, and then we'll hopefully kind of help us unpack some of this stuff. So I'm kind of just to give you guys, I always try to be super transparent with you guys to give you kind of a heads up. Over these next couple of weeks, my intention is to kind of like you know, wind down, make sure we're hitting everything you guys need to know for right now, and then take our break for Christmas, and then probably, you know, I'm going to kind of go dark as far as the investigation into this case for a bit until I can figure some of these things out. And so, like I said, we'll continue doing episodes, but I think that probably it doesn't make sense for me just to keep throwing out more information. So I want to make sure you have it all. And then I need to go find more information, if that makes sense. So that's what's coming. I believe the plan is, I already have it scheduled to talk to Dr. Jackson and have her on the show. But I believe that'll be mostly what you're going to hear on Sunday, is us kind of unpacking all this. And I want to probably use that opportunity to talk a little bit more about how this affidavit came and this video came into everyone's radar. So hang on tight. It's a wild ride and it's not over yet. So that'll be coming on Sunday. And then we'll talk to you guys again on Monday evening if you'd like to join us live for the Friday follow-up next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21+. Terms and conditions apply.